night for the last time after nearly 100 years on the air. It began in 1927 and featured Edward R. Murrow during World War II, Robert Trout, and Charles Osgood. The first broadcast of a World Series baseball game could be heard in 1938. The company announced it's ending the service because of challenging economic realities. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's a lovely morning, but unfortunately it might be clouding up, and we're going to talk about clear skies tonight. It's The Conversation on WVIK, a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Dino Milani from the Quad Cities Popular Astronomy Club. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's Conversation. Well, I don't know that you can have a show like this on the air for too long, and, you know, given its mission of celebrating Quad Cities' treasures without including in those treasures the Quad Cities Popular Astronomy Club. Dino Milani, thank you for being with us this morning.
Good morning, Kai. Pleasure to be here.
And, you know, it's funny because our paths have brushed against each other for decades. I mean decades.
Oh, easily. Since the 70s and later.
Yeah. And we're going to try to unpack all of that, but I want to start from the very beginning. Right. I know you live in Rock Island, and I know that your parents were here and fixtures in the community, but is this actually where you started, or did you guys move here when you were little, or have you been here the whole time?
I actually started in Champaign, Illinois when I was quite young, and then my father, Italo Milani, mm-hmm. who was an architect here for many years, still working, by the way, until age 92, until 2 months before he passed away, flew up, got a job interview, and then we wound up staying here pretty much since.
So about what age were you when you moved here?
Probably age 2.
Oh, so you're like me. That's another coincidence. Exactly. I was 2 when we came here, so I don't really have any memories of the other stuff. But Rock Island guy, what kinds of things when you were a kid, I always am fascinated by this. What were the things that sparked your imagination? For me, I loved reading about knights and, you know, the Arthurian legends. What was it that sparked your imagination?
Well, actually, literature did help quite a few things. Mm-hmm. But also, starting at age 12, I started reading Scientific American every month.
All right.
And followed that up and followed the science with that. And one of the things I really enjoyed was reading about anything on astronomy.
Hmm.
That led to a number of things, I suppose. When I finally went to college, 1976, we're going back a bit,
mm-hmm.
went to the University of Iowa, and one of the first courses I took was Introduction to Astronomy. And at that time, it was actually taught by Dr. James Van Allen, as in Van Allen radiation belt.
Yep. Yep.
The gentleman who actually helped put probably 60 different space projects up for NASA and elsewhere. Quite a few of the objects were actually built at the University of Iowa. So I took that course there, liked it, took a few more courses the next year as well with some of the other professors. It kind of grew from there. Then one goes off, one has to work and do other things, of course. And so it was laid aside for a while, but I kept my interest. And then probably almost 20 years ago, I joined the Popular Astronomy Club. At that time, we were actually meeting over in John Deere
mm-hmm.
at the, not the observatory, but the planetarium. We were using the planetarium then for
the John Deere
our
Planetarium
meetings.
At Augustana.
At Augustana
right
College,
there, yeah.
And so we met from there and went up, brought my son in on it. My wife, Ellen, as well, said, you should try that. And we went. And then since then have done quite a few things with the club.
And we're going to get into that. But I also am curious about what are those things that got in the way? You said, you know, you got to go out and you got to do some things.
Well, oh, you got to work. You got to make a living,
of course. What were those things for you?
Different jobs, different places. I actually worked for a while, actually, with the Department of Corrections at the IMCC. And it was interesting. It was actually also a medical facility. So
yeah.
You might say we dealt with the rather interesting cases.
Sure, sure. I would love to delve into with it sometime in the future, the history there, because I remember in our youth, it was the state hospital, the state mental hospital, right?
That was down in Mount Pleasant.
Well, I mean, there was a mental health component to the East Moline Center. Right?
There was that also, right? And that's on the Illinois side. Right?
And then it became strictly an East Moline Correctional Center. So I have memories of those earlier days, and then corrections evolves. And now next week, Augustana will be doing its second graduation ceremony inside East Moline Correctional Center. We'll be graduating 10 new Augustana alumni.
Why not? That's the best thing. The education seems
fantastic.
To help everyone.
Well,
and in fact, there was also the facility at Mount Pleasant, which at that time was a mental health hospital. For that one, I actually went with a psychology class down there.
Met
an interesting person who was in straps and other things too. And he looked at us like this, squints in his eyes. And we're like, who is this person?
Yeah.
Years later in corrections, I met him. Fairly pleasant.
Did you really?
Yes, but he was actually back in as an inmate elsewhere. So we had a little chat about that, and we both laughed about that. He said, oh, we knew you were coming. We're just doing that for fun.
Gotcha.
But.
Well, anyway, so you did lots of interesting things. Your father was a very famous architect. Did architecture ever have any allure for you?
Not for the business per se, but I did follow it very much and what he was doing as well. He did quite a few things for the community, quite a few projects up. For instance, the Martin Luther King Center, he did some work with them, quite a few others as well. He was one of the last people to help try to keep the old courthouse being torn down. And before he passed away, it was still up. And they didn't remove it until after he passed.
Right.
He's done an awful lot for the Quad Cities, and including some of the arts commissions and other things there. He helped found those, along with Don Wooten and some others, too.
Yeah. The legends.
They keep doing it, yes.
I was just at this last week. I went to the forum that they had about the Centennial Bridge plans, and I don't want to sound like a cynic, because most people know that I try to be an optimist at all times, but I've been around enough of these DOT-related projects to know that we can say whatever we want and have arguments as airtight as possible.
And they'll still do what they want to do.
And in the end, it's a decision that usually boils down to money and is made far away from us. But while I was there was someone who said, boy, I really like what you've done at the college. You guys really know how to hold on to your buildings. And this sort. And I had to remind him that, well, five of our first seven buildings had to be torn down because they were no longer useful. So there's the beauty component. There's also the pragmatic component. And who knows where this is going to land? I mean, I could, I don't know. Have you thought about the Centennial Bridge question at all?
As for removing it or anything else?
Relocating or renovating or...
Renovation's always a good thing. The bridge is still a good bridge. It's still used. Mm-hmm. We need something there. Mm-hmm. If we were to replace it, I don't think we need to at this point. The cost would be exorbitant. It's very similar to what we have at the I-74 bridge. Mm-hmm. Wonderful structure, but costly. Mm-hmm. So the same with that.
Yeah. I was surprised. I did a little research a year or two ago. The firm from, I believe, Omaha, that was the lead engineering firm, included the brother of the president of Augustana at the time. Conrad Bergendorf's brother was. Anyway, he was part of that whole thing. All right. You've already discovered, Dino, that we go anywhere we want to in this conversation. But let's get back to Popular Astronomy Club. So you started getting involved, say, 20 years ago or so.
That's correct.
And one of the great things about the club is that it is very welcoming and always inviting. And you don't have to be someone who has read all of Neil deGrasse Tyson's works.
Any interest you have is fine.
Right.
And there's no stipulations whatsoever. If you like the astronomy, just getting out to see the night sky, come join us, see what's going on. If you've got a telescope you want to just try out, come see us at one of our events, and we can help you try to figure out the scope for yourself and get it to work. And so it's actually open. It's part of our charter. As part of our charter, we are there to try to promote astronomy. And this goes back to the beginning of the club, 90 years ago. Okay. One of the gentlemen, Carl Gamble, who helped found the club, actually helped start the what's also known as the Astronomical League. The AAL is a collection of thousands of different clubs worldwide. And so we're one of the founding members of that club as well. Now, Carl actually had his own observatory. In 1941, at his property in Moline, his house overlooked the Rock River Valley, he built an observatory. It's called the Sky Ridge Observatory. 1941, he built that. And with that, he had a very good instrument. He had a Zeiss 5.5-inch refractor telescope. Now, that would be a triplet, very expensive at the time. If you were to buy one today, you know, looking at $10,000, $15,000 for the instrument. But 1951, it was not cheap then either. Carl probably reached 81,000 people in his lifetime talking about astronomy. Because literally every time they had an event, they would count the numbers, see how many would show up. So each and every one of the events, count them all up, 81,000. He did so much on the astronomy side that in 1954, Augustana gave him a doctorate of humanities in astronomy. And then when he was looking at passing away, he decided that, what am I going to do with my observatory and telescope when I'm gone? And so he made a will, talked with the president of Augustana College, donated everything to him. And when he died in 1958, they literally took down the observatory, took the telescope, dismantled it, hauled it off to Augustana College. Then Augustana started a fundraising event. And with that, they produced a book about him called The Man Who Unfolds the Heavens, which they used for about 17 years in different classes and things. And they kept going at it. And then finally, 1966, they had enough money. Comes down to, again, to the money. How do you do this? They had enough money to start the planetarium and the observatory. And they used a lot of Carl's equipment, including the
and
dome.
We still call it the Carl Gamble Observatory at Augustana College. And then below it is the John Deere Planetarium. And it's funny conjunction with human history in that in those 60s, America decided that it could not allow itself to fall behind the Soviets.
Absolutely. And so now it's the Chinese.
Well, but the Sputnik is going over, and that prompted, I mean, you have to, I've often wondered why a worldwide agronomy business would want to get involved in astronomy. Well, it was about the technological edge. And so we're grateful to John Deere, grateful to Carl Gamble. Now it has, I believe, a 15-inch Celestron device in the dome.
You used to have a 14-inch.
Was it 14?
That was the older one. And that one, I believe, was actually donated to the Boy Scouts. And it's currently out at the Loud Thunder Observatory in our club. The last year and a half, we've been out there rebuilding the dome, getting it to work, working on the telescope, getting that to work. So it's, again, available for the Boy Scouts to use. So that was donated to them.
Now, as a viewer, it makes a big difference. You mentioned Loud Thunder. That gets you just a little bit of remove from light pollution. But how far do you does the club go to get away from light pollution?
Well, it's not easy to get away from it, period. The only way to get rid of it completely is go out to the number of the dark sites. There's a few in Nebraska, a few in Colorado, Utah, places like that. Literally dark. There is actually, in these areas, there is actually a number of stipulations and laws that keep people from lighting the area so that at night it is dark. It is very similar to what we would have had maybe 100 years ago here before we started producing electric light and lighting everything up. I don't think the light helps. In fact, it actually hurts wildlife, hurts other things too, as well as not being able to see this night sky and see what's up there. it changes the way we think.
But you do some great things with local sites.
Yes.
So I know you have a partnership with my beloved Niobe Zoo. Tell me about that.
Oh, well, that's a good one. Well, every third Saturday of the month, we are at Niobe Zoo. We bring our PACMO, that's our Popular Astronomy Club's mobile observatory. It's literally a trailer with an observatory dome on top and a 12-inch Meade telescope inside. We actually have a nice little thing. It actually goes to the ground up, so we can have people walk around and they can shake the thing and the telescope doesn't move, which is good. We actually have different photography equipment attached to it also, and then a large monitor so people can see the objects if they want to show it to a group. Or if it's cloudy, then we can simply show some of the photographs of things we've taken over time. It works quite well. And then we bring out our own telescopes also. We'll have anywhere from 3 to 12 different telescopes up for the public to view. And again, this is open to the public. Anyone can come anytime. Again, third Saturday of the month, Niobe Zoo, after dark.
But I do want
unless
to put
it's
in
raining.
Plug. Yes, right. I want to put in a plug for the website where you can read about all of these things.
Right.
PopularAstronomyClub.org.
Correct.
Couldn't be easier. That's great. So remember, friends, you want to take a look at that and see what's going on. I'm often frustrated because from time to time, you know, we've got an astronomy program at Augustana. They'll do some kind of an event, and our club will staff it, and students will do a great job as docents to the night sky. But it's in today's media environment, it's hard to get the word out.
It is. It's very difficult to get that out.
It used to be everyone read the Argus, Dispatcher, Times.
And now we're not.
And right. So it's a lot harder that
so
way.
Much harder. But we do some things through Facebook. So you can go to the website with your browser, or you can go to Facebook and take a look at it there.
And start
Facebook seems
there.
To be a good thing for bringing the people in, at least.
Absolutely.
And so that's a good start.
You mentioned Carl Gamble, and I think what sparked that chemistry was a kindred spirit he found in Harry Nelson.
Yes.
Harry Nelson was a professor of mathematics who really introduced astronomy as a serious study at Augustana. Mm-hmm. And he was an eclipse chaser.
Yes, he was.
Have you done any of that?
Actually, yes. We've been to the last two solar eclipses.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I went down close to Carbondale. We stayed at Waterloo, Illinois, and watched it there the first time. And it was amazing to watch it. It was 90 degrees when we started. Then as the eclipse started, the temperature dropped. Things got quiet. The birds stopped singing. It was like going into nighttime, but then it got very dark all at once. And then you could see the sun and all the radii coming off from it. Absolutely amazing to see it.
Hmm.
And not very long.
Right. And I know that Dr. Nelson would go to the South Pacific.
Correct.
To try to find something like this. Hmm. And so
Then several would actually go to Antarctica, too. Some of the others as well, to find things for the for paleontology regions. They find all sorts of artifacts there.
Yeah.
And asteroids.
Right.
And meteorites. A lot of things to be found down there as well.
I'm sorry that Carl Gamble did not live long enough to see it, but part of the celebration of having the John Deere Planetarium and Carl Gamble Observatory was capitalizing on Dr. Nelson's many, many relationships, an amazing conference that was held at Augustana in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
We
mm-hmm.
chatted about that a little bit earlier, too. And it included that professor of yours, Dr. Van Allen.
Right. Dr. Van Allen was there, and also Neil Armstrong. So we've had quite a few good speakers, too. And then once a month, we do try to get speakers in with the club also. Last month, we had Dr. Michael Solentoy from Monmouth College, and he works with the new Vera Rubin Observatory. Now, the Vera Rubin Observatory is down south. It is photographing the night sky every 20 seconds, and it's going to be doing solidly for 10 years. Everything up there. They found in the first week over 10,000 new asteroids. In the first week. It's been a year since they've been open. And so we had quite a bit to share about what they found out there. Very interesting. So we always try to have a speaker through the club telling us about the things that are going on. For that one, we actually meet at Butterworth Center. It's always the second Monday of the month at Butterworth Center. The public is welcome to stop in. Come in and give us your name, and you're welcome just to see what's going on. If you can't make it, we actually do Zoom meetings, too, so people can see it at home as well.
Some years ago, I was at a conference at Arizona State University, mm-hmm. and they were celebrating the opening of their new next-gen planetarium. I'm used to the John Deere planetarium model, where you try to lean back in your seat and you're looking at a dome above you. This right. is more of a surrounding screen and 3D. And Arizona State is part of that project, which I'm sure you're aware of, where rather than scanning the entirety of the night sky, various facilities will just look at one. Mm-hmm. Because the farther you're looking distance-wise, the farther you're looking back into the past.
Oh, right? much farther than you think.
Oh, sure. But rather, I like that methodology that instead of each observatory trying to track everything, these guys have decided as a consortium to just take one little section. And even not moving your eyes left to right, metaphorically speaking, you are expanding just as mm-hmm. widely. I'm sure you're familiar with that project. I don't know who else is involved in it.
I'm a bit familiar with it. Yeah. I'd like to see more of it. It'd be fun to see how it works. But it's always interesting to see those things mm-hmm. too. Now, mm-hmm. The sky is huge. The distances are fantastic. If we were to look at some of the earliest galaxies that we can find now, let's go back to 13.4 billion years, okay? Mm. That's when that galaxy was formed. The light from that galaxy, the actual distance of that galaxy, if you were to measure that distance, it's more like 38.8 billion years for distance. Mm. Quite a large distance out, because we're expanding.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always good to see that. And again, if they focus on the one area, and you can expand and expand and expand tremendously, there's still an awful lot to see.
And that's the point I was really trying to get at, Dino, is that there's just so much yet to be discovered.
Our infancy on this. We're babies. We're worms in the woods. We have no idea what's really out there, but we're trying to find out.
And thanks to the Popular Astronomy Club, there's a lot of great ways to do that. You mentioned the program at NIAABI. What are some other opportunities, and the monthly meetings at Butterworth? What are some other ways that we can take part?
Well, we do actually have quite a few things at schools and libraries. So during the year, we'll be at different libraries, such as the Davenport Libraries, Moline Libraries, East Moline, okay, Rock Island Libraries as well. And so through the year, we'll have events, and we'll bring our telescopes up then. We'll speak about all sorts of things. During the winter months, we'll speak on different subjects. For instance, what is a telescope? How is it made? How do you put it together? How do you use it?
Mm-hmm.
What are asteroids? What are meteorites? How do you find them? That sort of fun thing. And other subjects, too. And for instance, in June, we're going to be at least two other locations. At NIAABI, of course, the third weekend in June.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to be at Illiniwek Park mm-hmm. on the 27th, the weekend following. And the day before that, we're going to be at the Bi-State Conservation Committee at the Wapsie River facility. That will be on the 26th. That's an interesting thing, too. And that's sponsored through NIAABI Zoo also.
Now, assuming I'm not writing this all down with a pen and paper, where could I find all this
information? You find it on a website. Again, it's the popularastronomyclub.org. Mm-hmm. And on the website, you're going to find our list of events. You're going to find also our newsletters. And our newsletters talk about the club, the different speakers, what they've said. Very interesting items there, too.
Well, and like the other things we're talking about, we've barely scratched the surface. So we're going to take just a little bit of a break and come back. And friends, as we sneak up on 29 minutes past the hour, you're listening to The Conversation on WVIK. And this week's guest, Dino Milani from the Quad Cities Popular Astronomy Club. Stay tuned. The Conversation will be right back.
Support for WVIK comes from Golder Care Solutions, offering advice about preserving assets, planning for the nursing home, and navigating Medicaid. Golder Care Solutions has been serving the Quad City since 2008. More information is at goldercare.com. And support for WVIK comes from the Regional Development Authority, distributing funds from the Rhythm City Casino Resort to help make the Quad Cities a more vibrant and inclusive community. Learn more at rdauthority.org. And support for WVIK also comes from Verde Dental,
A woman-owned small business committed to supporting the community, local businesses, and public radio. More information about Verde Dental is available at verdedental.com.
I'm Bill Hannon from Moline, and WVIK is my NPR station.
And thank you, Bill Hannon, for reminding us that this is our public radio station. And friends, you're listening to The Conversation and this chat with this week's guest, Dino Milani from the Popular Astronomy Club. So we've been talking about these discoveries. Well, I don't think we'll ever run out of new things to discover, but I'm always intrigued by the story from Genesis, where in one telling, a character takes a bite from the apple of from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and all this kind of stuff, and they lose innocence. So there's a corollary there that we lose a little bit of mystery and mystique and magic the more we learn. Do you ever see discoveries that take a little bit of the magic out, or is that just part of feeding the fire?
Occasionally you'll see those too, but really you don't.
Yeah.
The more you discover, the more that's out there, the more questions you have, the more you can find.
Yeah.
So literally, you don't lose that magic. You still find more. Because, for instance, when our club founded 1936, the club itself, at that time, we thought the entire universe was our own little galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, and everything else were just little objects, were part of it. That time, however, no.
Yeah.
They found out through variable stars and other things that, no, the galaxies are much more distant than we thought. They are out there. They're much larger ones as well.
And we're sort of in an out-of-the-way neighborhood of our own.
Oh, well, we are. It's not the biggest one, too, but it's not a bad spot to be. And so these are things we find.
Yeah.
We find all sorts of things, simple little things that we send out there. For instance, Voyager spacecraft. Mm-hmm. Okay. Again, built at the University of Iowa under James Van Allen. Okay. It's been out there for 50 years. It still has two of its instruments working after 50 years, which is absolutely amazing. It is now one light day from the Earth. So it has traveled as far as it takes light to travel one day. But it's taken 50 years to get there. If it were to go for one light year, it would take 18,250 years to go one light year. And that's not even as far as the nearest star, which is 3.3 or 3.4 light years away. So you'd have to multiply that more to see how long it would take. Now, that is if it's pointed at our nearest star, which it isn't. But it's been outside of our solar domain, outside the heliopause for our sun. It's picked up quite a bit of information just with those two little instruments. Mm. We know an awful lot more about it. So the more we see, the more we find, the more interesting it becomes.
Mm. Well, there was an interesting marriage of what we can discover on this one orb and then what goes beyond it, in that a lot of people know the name Frixell from Fritjof Frixell, who is the person for whom Augustana's Geology Museum is named.
Yes.
But he had some amazing children, and one of them was his son, Roald, who was on the faculty of one of the Northwestern universities, I think Oregon, I'm not sure which one, but he got to be with a team that studied the first geology brought back from the moon. So he was an extraterrestrial geologist, even though that's a bit of a misnomer there. But he was part of the reason that I think they attracted Armstrong here in the 70s, because they had worked together, and then with, of course, Van Allen. So the terrestrial, the extraterrestrial, and then on and on.
And they found quite a bit, too, with that. Having been a geologist, he actually took the rock, studied what its components were, and found out, gee, they're mostly lighter elements, but they're just like what we find here on Earth. What's going on? And so for that, it produced a new theory, which is actually a pretty good one, that our planet was hit sometime within about 400 million years of its creation by another body, maybe about the size of Mars. Wasn't too great a blow. Didn't split our planet to bits and pieces, but it did take off quite a bit. What remained kind of circled around and then formed our moon. So this is the Gaia theory of creation for the moon. So the moon itself is actually something that came from our own planet and another planet hitting us. The heavier elements went in. and sunk into the earth. The lighter ones were thrown out and formed what we have in the moon currently.
Right.
Interesting stuff.
Oh, it all is. It all is. And we're fortunate to have organizations like the Popular Astronomy Club that can keep that sort of that awe and that magic going for all of us. I will say, though, that this Frixell also worked on meteorites far outside of our immediate neighborhood.
Absolutely.
And we've got some over there across the street.
Right. We're actually a member also of the Planetary Studies Foundation, which is up, which originally had its museum in Elizabeth, Illinois. Fifth largest meteorite collection in the world up there. Okay. They had to close their doors to their museum. They lost their lease. And from that, actually, they had 16 of their glass cases. And my wife and I took those 16 cases and we took them to our own museum here in Rock Island, the Popular Doll and Toy Museum.
Hmm.
And we use those 16 cases now for the display of the dolls. But they originally held the meteorites, fossil samples, samples from the Mercury and the Apollo programs as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Robert Sapira. Is one of those people you send, if you don't know if it's a meteorite, you send it to him. He can find out for you and give you a valid answer. He's been to Antarctica 3 times as well to find meteorites on the ground and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, extra items.
Well, now, what is it? I want to delve into this a little bit, too. The nature of an organization that can bring together some really high-end things, the concepts that you're talking about, but can also still light that fire in a 12-year-old's brain.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, how do you guys manage that as a mission?
Oh, well, it's very simple. We simply set up our instruments and say, come on up. Here, grab this stool and take a look. Hmm. Tell me what you see. Now, for instance, we'll point it at Jupiter. We'll say, okay, what do you see? Well, I see an object in the middle. Okay, do you see bands across the middle? Yeah. Do you see anything outside it? 4 little points? They said, yeah. Okay, those 4 little points are the moons. What do you think? Or how many do you count? We literally, for the younger ones, we can get them up there and they become excited immediately to see these things. It's always great. When we're up with the public, the energy level just goes sky high because we're doing so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun.
Well, it is fun, and we like to have fun, you know, on WVIK, which is why every week at this time we step aside for just a moment and hear stories with origins a little closer to River City, and that is time for Rock Island Lines with Professor Roald Tweet.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. Back in the 1850s, Chicago challenged St. Louis to a duel that was fought at Rock Island. Chicago was an upstart kid, a swamp with a fort and a few houses, while St. Louis was a gracious, matronly city. St. Louis and Chicago realized that only one of them had a chance of becoming the fabled Queen City of the West, the great American inland metropolis. As a weapon, St. Louis chose the steamboat. Her riverfront controlled all the traffic to and from the upper Mississippi and Missouri rivers. By 1850, the waterfront was often choked with steamboats carrying passengers upriver to farm the Midwest and produce back down to New Orleans. Chicago chose the newfangled Iron Horse, a noisy, brash machine that could go on rails wherever it darn well pleased. In 1854, the tracks of the Chicago and Rock Island Railroad reached the Mississippi River at Rock Island, giving shippers and passengers an alternative route to the east, bypassing St. Louis. But the train tracks kept going. On April 22, 1856, the first locomotive ever to cross the Mississippi chugged across a new bridge between the island and Davenport. The duel was on. Steamboatmen claimed that the bridge was deliberately located at a place where side currents made it hard for boats to pass the swing span. On May 6th, the steamboat Effie Afton left Rock Island for St. Paul. Just after passing the bridge, her paddles stopped, and the boat was carried back against a pier. The boat caught fire, and so did the bridge. Was it an accident or a plot to destroy the bridge. Steamboats within sight of the wreck blew their whistles. The subsequent lawsuit dragged on for 6 years. The steamboatmen argued that they were there first and asked that the railroad bridge be removed. Railroads argued that the rivers belonged to everyone. When the United States Supreme Court decided for the railroad in 1862, and bridges began to spring up all along the Mississippi, St. Louis knew she had lost, destined to live in the shadow of that toddling railroad town, Chicago.
Rock Island Lines with Roll Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And we get to continue hearing Rock Island Lines because folks just like you become members of WVIK and keep programs like this very locally focused on the air. You can catch Rock Island Lines each week at this time on The Conversation. And this week's episode having to do with that first rail bridge, I don't know. I'm trying to think if the timing is right as to when he recorded that episode, but there's a great history that came out of a couple of Illinois historians. I think at least one of them related to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign called Lincoln's Greatest Case, and it really dives into the story. And of course, now we have a beautiful piece of public art at the foot of the government bridge, the Iowa Foot, where it depicts Lincoln talking to a young man trying to get a perspective. Not exactly historically accurate, but as Tweet himself would have said, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. My guest this morning is Dino Milani. I have three friends named Dino. And
yes.
Wouldn't you know I'd screw things up just that easily. Dino Milani is my friend, and he's here from the Quad Cities Popular Astronomy Club. We're talking about that organization and all of the wonderful things that it does. What I want to ask you about now, though, is a little bit more personal. The whole nature of discovery demands curiosity.
Absolutely.
You and I are not far off in age. I think one thing that happens with a few too many trips around the sun is we have a tendency to lose some of that curiosity, which keeps us so vital. What are the things that you do to fan that flame?
Fan that flame? Oh, well, simple. I keep reading on the subject, first of all. Sky and Telescope magazine is a real good start for that. Also, a publication from Texas called Stardate. Mm-hmm. Again, very good publications. You can find some interesting things there you can't find in the other things, too. There's various journals and other things you can find, too. But there is more that you can do also. You can become what is known as a citizen scientist. Okay. There's a website called Zooniverse. Zooniverse, Zooniverse, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they sponsor projects for citizen scientists. Now, if you remember, I mentioned earlier the Vera Rubin Observatory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can actually go to Zooniverse, and you can find several projects there to help them find meteorites and other objects. So this is taking photographs of the night sky, thousands of photographs every night. And so they need people to look through these, find objects that would be different. Find other asteroids, find planets and other things too. And so the citizen scientist thing is one of those things. And what we may be able to find with that is, if it's in the right space, we may be able to find Planet Nine, that large chunk that's out in the Oort sphere. That's about maybe 10 times the size of the planet Earth. But it's so far out that we can't see it. So we may be able to find that with the data from the Vera Rubin Observatory. And people who become part of that Zooniverse group as citizen scientists may be the ones that actually find it.
Hmm.
So it's searching, 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 but finding the answer. It's like anything in life. You learn everything that you need, about 80% that you need, and then you spend the rest of your life trying to find the 20% that really matters. Well, it's a similar thing here. We've learned a lot. Now we need to find those little bits. And that's one way to do it.
Well, I love the way you put that. And one of those little bits that I just learned this morning is that we both share a past with the Genesius Guild. Tell me
absolutely
about that.
Yes.
How did you get roped in there?
Well, I don't know. Just one of those things that kind of happened. And I think it was 1973 I joined them. I was with them for 9 years with Don Wooten and others, too. We did everything, you know, help build the stages, take down the things, worked with the costume groups, acted on stage quite a bit as well. So every summer we'd do that. And that's one way to keep your mind active and do other things, I suppose. It was good. It gave me a very good education on the classics. For instance, Greek literature, Greek drama, Greek comedy, Shakespeare, and then other things too. And then we actually started doing operas too, if I remember too. So those were always fun.
Partnerships with the Quad Cities Mozart Festival for a while. Those were great too. But that's fantastic. And I didn't realize I was going to walk right into a plug, but a couple of weeks from now, we'll be having Kate Bodenbender on the program. And she's going to be directing The Taming of the Shrew later this summer. The season starts June 6th and 7th with Love's Labor's Lost. And it's going to be a
good
great
fun
season
one
ahead.
For people to see. Yes.
And as ever in its long, glorious history, dates back to 1956, you are guaranteed to get your money's worth because it's absolutely free. So anyway, and then for the Popular Astronomy Club, so many of the things that you do are
absolutely free as well.
How do you manage the finances? Is it contributions, memberships? What sorts of things do you do to make sure?
Well, we do have a nominal fee for members. You know, $30 for a person, $35 for a family, something like that. Very nominal if you want to become a member. But other than that, we do grants from people as we show up, you know, say we'd like this, please, as a grant for showing that does help. But often, no. It's often our members itself that actually does most of the contributing to keep the club going.
Well, we're grateful for the partnership with the Rock Island County Forest Preserve District through Niobe and Illiniwek and Loud Thunder, which is, I don't think you're actually inside the Forest Preserve. You're more at the camp, right? The Boy Scout
Correct,
camp?
Correct, it's Boy Scout camp. Yeah.
But these are all hidden treasures, and I'm grateful for the fact that you reside in Rock Island. I had a couple of occasions to visit your folks' house, which was one of those things. You know, part of the Rock Island brand that I got to say I really appreciate is We don't put our flash on display and sort of be gaudy about it, as some other communities might do. Your folks' house, treasure, beautiful corner of Rock Island, that particular neighborhood, that micro neighborhood is a hidden gem. So I'm not going to tell people where it is. But one of the things I loved about that home, it was you could go past it 1,000 times in a lifetime.
And never know what it was.
And never even realize
it. Well, it's like anyone else. Yeah. You have to look and see.
Yeah. Look and see. I like that attitude. That's a good one to have. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the Aurora Borealis.
Yes.
We had a great year for that over the past 12 months.
Well, the sun has been very active. Because of that, we have the aurora.
Yeah.
It's the activity from the sun that causes the aurora. As it hits the upper atmosphere, it causes that as well.
But I want to know, why is it such a bedevilment to get accurate forecasts? My spouse and I, we had that one night last year that it was gorgeous. I mean, we could, with just a simple camera lens, stand on our front porch
right here in the Quad
Cities,
you could see all sorts of things. Yes.
And so we thought, well, we both got early mornings tomorrow, and let's just go out and look tomorrow night, because they thought it was going to be, and then the next night with complete dud.
Right.
How do you understand they forecast these things?
Okay, well, there actually are a couple of sites through NASA and elsewhere where you can take a look and find the aurora and see what it's going to look like. And it'll actually show you a map of the planet from above, from the north. Mm-hmm. And so it'll show you where the aurora will be. Well, this, if it's going to be in Canada or move down into the United States or elsewhere. That's one way to do it. But, and it's based on, it's quite a bit of science too, because you have to base it on the magnetic fields on the Earth, what it is allowing through, what it is not allowing through, and how much activity out of the sun. If the sun is inactive, which it was for quite a few years, we don't get much on the aurora side. When it is active, and there's quite a few sunspots and other things, more coming from the sun, that hits our planet, hits our atmosphere, then again, the radiation build up there lets it through or doesn't let it through, and you just have to look at that. Again, it's not easy to do. Now, there is a, last weekend, Ellen and I went to one of the conventions for the Astronomical League.
Mm.
Okay, NACRO, which is the North Central region of the Astronomical League, up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. They've got a great planetarium up there. Must be four domes.
Hmm.
Some of the equipment I actually used in the 1970s, 1976. It's still there. It was donated by the University of Iowa up there. Okay. That, we actually got a tour the next day at the University of Iowa in the astronomy labs, the James Van Allen astronomy labs. We got to go upstairs and we got to see their engineering model of their Tracers satellite.
Hmm.
Interesting model there, too. This is the third one they're building up there. And that's one of the objects that's used to try to find our bands, find our electronic field. What's going on? What's happening? And so with that, then we can trace the aurora, see where it's going to be. And so it's a lot of these instruments we put up in space that help us find these things.
Hmm.
And so, again, it was fun to see that.
It kind of goes back to that earlier question I had for you, and maybe I was too facile the first time around, but there was a magic and a mystery around that, as well as around eclipses. There was
Absolutely.
The famous story of the Battle of Fredericksburg when there was an aurora borealis visible as far south as Maryland, and it said different things to the Union and Confederate soldiers who were laying out in the battlefield seeing it. An eclipse can mean different things. And, but when you take lay the science on, which is absolutely necessary and I think awe-inspiring in its own way, it does take a little bit of the innocent magic away.
It does, because people at the time, if you don't know what it is, what is it? Sun's going away. It's getting dark. It's getting cold. What's happening? It was a battle in China. Probably about 1,000 or so BC or so. The aurora borealis happened during the battle. They stopped fighting. At that point, that was the end of the combat. And so they looked at that and said, no, something's happening. We have to stop.
Mm.
But as we know what it is, it's different.
And for the Norse mythos, not understanding what this was, mm-hmm. it was all part of the way that the gods traveled between realms. If they saw this happening, I think it's overly simplified nowadays as the Rainbow Bridge. But
going back to Norse mythology.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was what was the way to get to Asgard. But I mean, whenever you saw that in those, it was just simply a sign that the gods were very active. They were doing a lot of,
That's one way to, that's one way we thought of it for many years until we realized what it was.
It's good, though, to keep a little bit of mystery. Now, there's a great new addition to the popular imagination around astronomy, and that's the film Project Hail Mary.
Mm-hmm.
I assume you've seen it?
I haven't seen it yet. We'll see it sometime soon.
Okay. Have you read the book?
I'm reading it now.
You are reading it, because the curiosity
and it's
is
an interesting story, good, based on a lot of things that you can find from the 1950s, science fiction and other things too, but a little better twist at the end, so a good one to read.
Well, and that's what I want to know about is the science. So just this week, unfortunately, we saw the end of the Stephen Colbert Show. In his last episode, he had Neil deGrasse Tyson on, and they're pretending to have this sort of a wormhole, I don't know the exact name of it is, between parallel universes, and then they're making a good joke out of it, and finally Tyson says, yes, but this is unbelievable, Stephen. Looks right at the camera. This is unbelievable.
Correct.
Because they're fictionalizing everything with it. But I was just curious if you had any idea on the science behind Project Hail Mary.
Well, for the science for it, that'll have to wait.
You'll
have to read the book to find out.
All
right. The science is not bad. The science is fairly good. A few little quirks here and there I wonder about. I'll find out some details.
Okay.
That. But it's not bad. It's a good read, period. So for that...
And why not?
Go for it.
Speaking of good reads, I love to ask guests of mine, what kinds of things do you like to read? What's been occupying your nightstand of late?
It comes back to a lot of the stuff on the science, but again, quite a bit of classical fiction, you might say,
mm-hmm.
again.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've been tolling through a lot of the 1940s and 50s science fiction short stories, probably about 6,000 or 8,000 of those, and just finding all sorts of interesting things. You find some interesting ideas in there, some mm-hmm. ideas that actually work out later on, and other things that don't. And so it helps you to maybe get a little better understanding what's going on around you. But the popular fiction and the classic fiction tell you so much more, too. For instance, I was reading The Trumpet Major and some other things as well. Interesting book along those lines. But those are just some additional items.
Well, and I think another little conjunction here, I've decided to start my summer reading with a little bit of bubblegum and stuff from the 30s, uh-huh. but not science fiction, Horatio Hornblower and C.S.
Oh, yes.
Forrester.
I actually read all of those, and I read all those
did,
when I was
I
quite young.
I did that 30 years ago, and I got to do it again now.
And they were good. It was good fiction, and it still is. Now,
and it's good.
He was a decent writer.
It's a good maritime history, too.
Absolutely.
He knew his way around a sail, so there's that. But famously, Gene Roddenberry said he based Kirk on Horatio Hornblower.
Absolutely.
In terms of his panache and so on and so forth. But there are some other things on the reading list. I'm hoping to get to Queen Esther by John Irving. See, if I say this out loud, Dino, I get a little accountability for myself. And then Theo of Golden. I've heard so many good things about mm-hmm. this book, Theo of Golden. Very exciting that a great book to have read a year or two ago, Remarkably Bright Creatures, is now a film on Netflix. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but it's a beautiful, sweet film with Sally Fields and
a fairly recent film, is it?
Very recent, just
we'll have to
out.
Look at it sometime.
The guy, is it Albert or Alfred Molina? I think it's Alfred Molina. Anyway, as the voice of the central character, Marcellus the Octopus. And how can you go wrong with a book that has as its central character an octopus? Other things that you're consuming in media, whether it's books or movies or anything like that?
Oh, I don't know. We've been fooling around with a lot of the British TV stations, BritBox and Acorn and things like that, and watching quite a few things along those lines.
Well, give me some recommendations, because I always want to get into BritBox. I haven't done it yet. But when I do, what should I be watching?
Shetland. Okay, now this is a series. It's a crime drama based in the islands north of Scotland. Very interesting what happens with things. Long plots. And so it'll about 8 or 10 episodes to finish a plot.
Yeah.
But all the details, very fascinating.
Well,
and it deals with the history, too. And everyone seems to be related in the small islands. They all know each other quite well.
I think it's so intriguing that a lot of the most popular crime type of fiction is set in some of the most idyllic little places, like the whole Three Pines series in Anglophone Quebec. It's beautiful places that you'd want to go and visit and vacation, and yet they have these gruesome murders.
That's the writers like
what
that.
To make up like that. So please refresh. We're going to run out of time here in a minute, but Dina, what are some of the next things coming up that I can take part in or I can learn about as a fan on the Public Astronomy website?
Okay. Again, popularastronomyclub.org. Popularastronomyclub.org. Go there to check our schedule. Again, come and visit our events. We've got a list of different libraries we're visiting.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Niabe Zoo every third Saturday of the month. Again, this month, Alinawick Park on the 27th. And then quite a few things coming up through the year. So that's the first thing you do. And then I'm going to finish up with one little statement.
Yes, please.
And that's one of our popular phrases we always end our meeting with, which is keep looking up.
Keep looking up.
Keep looking up.
Oh, I love that. Hey, it's going to have to do it for this week, though, and I'd like to end on that. Keep looking up. I want to thank my guest, Dino Milani from the Quad Cities Popular Astronomy Club. And just remember, friends, you can always catch the conversation twice each week on WVIK, Saturday morning live like you just did at 10 o'clock, and then there's a rebroadcast nowadays on Monday evenings at 8, right after Fresh Air. You can always find recent episodes at WVIK.org, and looking for us under the podcast tab. From the campus of Augustana College, this is Kai Swanson inviting you to join us next week for the conversation on WVIK when our guest will be adventurer and guitarist Dana Starkel. That's right, he's coming back and we'll see if we can finish the story. Join us next week at that time. Until then, get out and enjoy a beautiful day, and when the skies do clear, check out popularastronomyclub.org for all the great fun to do there. Have a great week, friends. News is next, and then Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
You've been listening to The Conversation on WVIK. If you missed part of it or just want to hear it again, tune in at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, right here on WVIK. Support for WVIK comes from Source Bookstore, offering thousands of used and out-of-print books in all genres, music and movies. Open 7 days a week at 232 West 3rd Street in Davenport, serving the Quad Cities for 86 years. That's Source Bookstore.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Riley.
And WVIK is our NPR station.
Broadcasting from the campus of Augustana College at 90.3 FM and HD, WVIK Rock Island, and 95.9 FM K240DZ Dubuque. Online at WVIK.org or with the WVIK app. WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.